You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length, members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy. Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to the show once again. And as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Daniel Mallory Ortberg. With me in the studio this week is a longtime friend of the show, John Levitt, a writer and artist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, Motherboard, Racked, and Marvel Comics. His work has also appeared in The Toast, but I can see that that is no longer an important part of your bio because it no longer exists.
I wondered if I should put it in the bio or just have you mention it.
Frankly, I think you were correct in assuming that I would find a way to work it into the conversation.
I trusted you, yeah.
I think it's wise to only include publications that still exist on your resume.
Actually, half of those no longer exist now, so.
Oh, God. Yeah, fair enough.
There's like a good 2-year stretch where I was the angel of death for online publications.
I think anyone who has ever done any freelance writing feels a little bit that way. Although Racked is living on, I believe, in an afterlife at Vox. And, you know, I'm sure someday The Toast will be bought up by, I don't know, Brian Goldberg's ghost.
It'll be replatformed as an entirely literal toast-based vertical.
Honestly, that's fine. You know, that is not too bleak a picture of the future as far as I'm concerned.
Right. And I'm just going to apologize. We're recording in my apartment and I am like surrounded by intermittent construction noise because somehow even the Upper West Side can get gentrified.
I mean, I love that you found a way to work the fact that you live in the Upper West Side into this conversation. Thank you. We will be prepared for any construction noise. And thank you for just generally bringing a wonderfully withholding WASP energy to the show already.
Yes, I am not smiling, but I can tell you my heart is breaking.
I sincerely hope not, Mr. Simpson. Okay, we are mixing our waspy characters. I actually am going to read this first letter because it has made me so mad. I have not been able to sleep. I think about this guy and he makes me furious. So I deserve to get to read things about him is how I see it. So the subject here is consent agenda. Dear Prudence, my husband of several years and I have been having more discussions about consent lately. Which is generally a great thing, but he's taking things to extremes in a way that's taking a lot of the joy out of our relationship. At first, he decided that he didn't want to engage in any physical intimacy without explicitly discussing consent and parameters each time, and I was on board with that, thinking it would actually improve our connection. However, he recently decided he doesn't want to have any physical contact whatsoever without discussing consent first, so no spontaneous hugs and kisses or hand-holding. He moved out of our bedroom because he doesn't want to risk having incidental contact during the night that one of us didn't explicitly consent to. Last week, he got angry because I tapped him on the shoulder to get his attention while he had headphones on. I tapped him very lightly with one finger. He says he felt physically assaulted and that I should have texted him to interrupt him, not initiated physical contact. I don't know where this is coming from. In the past, neither one of us had ever expressed concern that the other wasn't obtaining consent clearly enough, or that less touching generally would be in order. Of course, the right of any person not to be touched at any time for any reason overrides anyone else's desire for affection, but sleeping alone every night and asking my husband if I can hug him is not what I had in mind for our marriage. He did agree to marriage counseling, but we're on a waiting list that could take a couple of months or more to work through. So any advice you might have in the meantime to navigate this would be much appreciated.
Harsh intake of breath through the nose, yeah.
Yeah. I before I get really mad, because I think that that is the correct response to this, I want to pause and say, I suppose that it is possible that your husband is dealing with some trauma he has never shared with you and that has come up lately for unknown reasons And that he doesn't right now have good language for telling you what he's dealing with or why. And, you know, if that's the case, maybe there's a way that therapy will be helpful to the two of you and you can find a way to work through this. But my read on this is that your husband has adopted the language of, you know, consent and space in order to control you and to make you feel like you have to walk on eggshells around him and to punish you and to make you feel like you're a bad person for wanting to hug him. That's my read on this.
I'm more or less the same. I want to get out in front of this and say, you know, if there's a case that is, if their husband is very literal or maybe very legalistic, like some of this is kind of lawyer behavior, but there is a theory in labor practice called a Kolkani strike or a rule book strike, where the workers strike by obeying the rules very exactly and by like going slow. So like, I think he may be engaging in a bad faith Kolkani strike in their relationship.
Yeah, again, that was my thought here, too. Like, this does not read to me like somebody who is currently trying to, like, work through trauma and is panicked. This reads to me like an attempt to control, manipulate, and cow another person, basically. Saying, I don't want to accidentally touch you during the night, either implies that this guy thinks that his partner is so... Like he's either assigning to the letter writer a sensitivity the letter writer clearly doesn't have, or, you know, is trying to say, if you were to accidentally roll over and our hands touch in the middle of the night, that would somehow violate or be painful to me for reasons that I'm not willing or available to go into, which is just, again, in the absence of I'm suffering from something profound and overwhelming and I need your help processing it. Just seems to me like totally baffling, totally unreasonable, a total abuse of the idea of the language of consent or the basic idea of consent. And it's just not, it's just like a twist and perversion of what talking about consent means.
Yeah, no, it's nothing about this really feels like it's in good faith unless they've been hiding, as previously mentioned, some never brought up trauma that has just suddenly emerged coincidentally with this discussion of consent.
Yeah. So, you know, on the one hand, like, as you say, if your husband has made it clear that he doesn't want to be touched without checking in, you know, don't do that, certainly. But it also sounds like he's kind of trying to claim this needs to be the rules for both of you. So if you haven't already, letter writer, I think to make it really clear, like, husband, if you need to talk about something, we can do that. But you need to know on my end, I am very comfortable with sleeping in the same bed at night and accidentally touching each other. I am comfortable with spontaneous hugs and kisses. So if this is something that you want to talk about, we can do that. But please do not pretend that this is something both of us want or need. And if he hears that and he is able to say, okay, fair enough, this is me, this is my stuff, this is what I want, maybe you'll be able to uncover something more. But if he tries to come back with this sort of like, no, this is how it ought to be, this is the right way for us to engage with one another physically, then that really, again, that sets up the red flags for me that suggest that this is like a really fucked up way to keep you constantly on edge, constantly feeling guilty, constantly feeling apologetic, and constantly like you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, this letter is definitely like a Mayday's parade worth of red flags.
Yeah. So, you know, I would say you're on a waiting list for couples counseling that could take a couple of months or more. So don't feel like, okay, I guess I will just move through my house like a ghost until then and text my husband if I have permission to tap him on the shoulder. I think it's the time is long since overdue to have a conversation of, you know, where is this coming from? And because he's your husband and because you apparently love him and you want to try to give him the benefit of the doubt, I think it's fair to, you know, ask that with an open mind and say, can you tell me more about where this is coming from? This really surprises me. As I look back in the history of our marriage, I don't see anything that makes me think, wow, we were handling consent or touching our boundaries really badly before. What's changed for you? And, you know, if he's got an answer. And that doesn't mean, like, again, if there is, like, on the off chance that there's some serious trauma here that he's just starting to work through, I don't want you to say, like, you know, give me a laundry list of reasons right now or I'm fucking out of here. But he needs to give you something other than just this is what consent looks like, because that's not true. So even if it's just he says something's come up from my past that I'm not really ready to go in depth about, but this is what I need for now, you know, you could work with that. And I do want to leave space for that. I know I was initially like really mad, but if there's even a 5 to 10% chance that he is just really reacting right now to his trauma in a way that he doesn't really know how to bring it up or how to ask for what he needs, I want to leave room for that possibility here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really painful and I'm really sorry. But, you know, at least if he can be honest about that with you, you can know, okay, this isn't necessarily my fault. This is something that he's going to try to work through, and I can hopefully be helpful to him, and we can maybe set aside some time when we can touch and it is okay. But if he's giving you nothing, and if he just kind of comes back with, this is just how things need to be from now on, you and I need to kind of treat each other like, you know, mutual prisoners of war, and our bodies are kind of no man's land, and he's just like, that's the way things need to be. That's really isolating. That's really painful. That's really cruel. And I think if he's not giving you any really justification for it, that's heartbreaking. And I think you need to talk to the other people in your life about it, like ask for help and support, maybe ask for a hug from a close friend and figure out whether or not that's what you want from your marriage.
Yep. All excellent advice and much more understanding than I would be when I first read this question.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I do think the likeliest explanation is probably that wherever this is coming from, this is out of a desire to control. But maybe not.
Yeah, on the off chance, it's not.
Yeah, but man, oh man, you know, this idea that, hey, I want to talk about consent. New rule that I'm imposing is that we never touch unless we've, like, sat down and hammered it out. Again, just reads like a parody of yeah, what, you know, like a troll thinks consent is.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, you don't want to endure a sit-down strike in your own marriage.
Yeah, because, I'm not suggesting that, like, if you're married to someone, you should be cool with being touched constantly and you should never talk about it. That's not at all what I would say. But the terms your husband is proposing is one that basically acts like there's no pre-existing trust between the two of you.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's not that, then either there's something he needs to share with you that he needs help with, or he is attempting to turn your marriage into an incredibly tense, terrifying, fraught place where you feel like you have to ask his permission to hold hands. And that feels like a real red flag, because that could absolutely get pretty emotionally fucked up pretty fast. Whew. And, you know, keep us posted. I want to know if you guys are able to talk more and if he has anything to kind of explain this sudden, really abrupt change and where this is coming from. Yay, we're doing so great.
We're doing so great. And this next one, I'm excited for.
I feel like there's a lot we can do here. Which one are you, by the way? Because the subject is practical man married to a hopeless romantic. Are you one of those two categories of people? Are you both? What's your deal?
Oh, my deal is I get to talk about social reproduction theory.
Oh, good. Okay. Fantastic. Then I will read this letter and then get out of your way. All right. Dear Prudence, my wife of 20 years is a hopeless romantic who wants old-fashioned doting and wooing. Those are her words. She wants me to completely set up and surprise her, for example, with Valentine's Day plans. But nothing is a bigger turnoff for me than treating another adult in this manner. I was a teenage father, and I've had people entirely dependent on me my whole life. I long for a practical partnership, someone locking arms with me and tackling life together. She's a stay-at-home mother, and our kids are all older, so now she has 10 times the available time for planning, scheduling, etc. than I do working a demanding job. I love her, so of course I make a good faith effort to indulge her romantic side from time to time. But she sees this as an emotional need and something she, quote, can't live without. How can I navigate this seeming incompatibility without building resentment on either side? You've got a theory for this.
Yeah. Okay. So there's social reproduction theory, which basically states that everything done outside the formal job of selling your labor to get money also counts as work. That includes things such as raising children, having children, scheduling appointments, being romantic, keeping the house in tidy order, educating children. So what I hear here is someone who is of 20 years, a wife of 20 years. So you've known this person for a very long time. This isn't something they just sprung on you. They have been laboring for you, providing the work of social reproduction for 20 years, and now they've got more time. Sorry, you've got to pay up. Suck it up.
I love it. Yeah. She clocked out for the day.
Yeah, she's clocked out. And I, if it turns you off this much, why are you still married?
Yeah, I'm definitely curious about like the kind of partnership I want. Is somebody locking arms with me? And yet for 20 years, I've had my partner be a stay-at-home parent. And like maybe that was 100% from her. Maybe you were like, no, baby, I really want to both split childcare 50-50, which, maybe you tried that. Maybe you tried that really hard. And she was like, absolutely not. We are lucky enough to have enough money that one of us can stay home full time. And I insist that it be me. But, I kind of doubt that she bullied you into letting her be a stay-at-home mother. I kind of wonder whether that worked for you for a really long time and now it doesn't. And you're trying to kind of frame this as like, oh, no, what I need is this kind of partner that she isn't, when it's like, I think you probably got a lot out of this situation for a really long time.
Yeah, no, I'm sitting here with a banner that says like wages for housework. So I'm like, if that means you have to like occasionally schedule a Valentine's Day thing, or maybe you need to surprise her with a dinner, just suck it up.
Yeah, and again, I think it's also fine if part of what you want is sometimes for her to surprise you. Like I would actually have a lot of room for, if you said, I also want to feel valued in this fashion and I want to sometimes ask for certain surprises or certain celebrations. But phrasing asking somebody to like surprise you with flowers and a nice dinner on something like Valentine's Day, and then saying, as a former teenage father, which like, that means that you got a teenage girl pregnant. And I bet that was a lot harder for her than it was for you. Like, yeah. Not that being a teenage father isn't hard, but like you didn't have to give birth, man.
I'm just like, yep, she's clocked out.
Yeah. So just that kind of like, well, I was a teenage father. And it's like, okay.
Takes two to tango, mister. Come on.
That doesn't mean like because you got a teenager pregnant when you were a teenager, you now shouldn't have to take your wife out to dinner once a year. That's not the like get out of jail free card you seem to think it is.
Yes, no. Meet a minimum standard of maintaining an emotional relationship.
Yeah, and this whole like I've had people entirely dependent on me for my entire adult life. Let's pick that apart a little bit.
I talk to a single mom every once in a while.
Yeah. And this whole idea of like you're grouping, I don't think that this it's unclear whether or not your wife of 20 years is the same person you became a father with as a teenager. It kind of sounds like those are two different women. The grouping together of the women who have been partnered to you with the children you have helped raise is, how do I say it? Super gross and sexist. How do you say? Oh, fucking disgusts me. That was a very bad French accent. I feel like I'm being very hard on this letter writer. So I just want to clarify again. It is okay to sometimes feel like you're being asked a lot and you haven't asked for much in return. If there's something in particular that you want or need, I think it's always good to speak up and advocate for yourself. I don't think that you are a horrible monster, and I'm very glad that you have been able to provide financially for your family in such a way that one of the parents was able to stay home and raise the kids full time. But, again, asking to be wooed is not the same thing as dependence. That's asking to be treated specially and with delight and to be affirmed. And framing that as the same thing as like a child needing to be fed on a regular schedule because they are physically helpless is, again, gross. Don't do that. They're not the same thing.
both parties need to come to the negotiating table as labor and management and work out an organization that
No, no, because I feel like this guy already sees himself as management and the women in his life as, like, employees.
No, I was speaking to him that way because that seems like the way he understands it.
Oh, you see, I want him to stop understanding it in that way. I need him to stop thinking of himself as, like, the foreman of his home factory.
Well, perhaps some of those, like, you know, as you mentioned, maybe he has some needs as well that could be met. Mm-hmm. And they could meet themselves a little halfway. But again, it doesn't sound like she's asking for much.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you want to say, like, I don't want to do this all the time, I would like to sometimes also be, you know, given flowers, or I would occasionally as a gift like to have a Sunday all to myself where I just like read and go for a walk and I don't, you know, take care of anybody. All that's fine. And you're allowed to ask for those things. You know, comparing wanting to be treated specially on an anniversary or Valentine's Day to the kind of dependence that being a parent requires is not okay. You need to stop doing it. And you navigate this by finding ways to compromise, talking to one another reasonably, not with like, this is the biggest turnoff in the world and you are dependent on me like a child when you want a nice dinner. And also, you know, look at why did you marry a hopeless romantic and then also have a like one person works outside of the home and one person works in the home, presumably for no wages for such a long time? And why is it only bothering you now when mm-hmm. all that's being asked of you is the occasional, again, like bouquet and box of chocolates? That seems like kind of doable, my guy.
Yes. Very doable.
Yeah. So that is, I think, is as generous as I'm going to be to that letter writer. I got nothing else. I got nothing else left to give him. So we're going to move on to a very different kind of father.
And oh,
you get to read this letter and have fun okay. with it. Have a great time.
Subject. My dad hired an escort for me. Dear Prudence, my dad took me to see an escort over the winter break. He knew I was a virgin and thought I'd be thrilled at having sex for the first time with a beautiful, experienced woman. I freaked out when I realized what was happening and that, in fact, my dad also sees escorts without my mom's knowledge. My dad crossed a huge boundary and I'm furious with him. He said if my mom found out, their marriage would be ruined, and I didn't want to destroy Christmas for my sisters, so I kept quiet. I don't even know if I could explain what happened to my mom. I feel ill and ashamed whenever I think about my dad. He's apologized, but I don't want to talk to him at all. I can't afford therapy on my own, and I don't know how to explain to my mom why I suddenly need to talk to a professional. Sometimes I feel like I'm a wimp who is overreacting. What do I do with these emotions?
Jesus.
I'm going to betray my heritage, my staunch New England heritage here and just say nothing, repress it, create a reason why you're seeing a psychiatrist.
Like, yeah, I'm so, A of all, I am just wildly sorry that this happened.
Yeah, I don't think you're overreacting at all. Like, this is extremely messed up. This is not normal.
This is, like, in every way that your father could have put you in the worst possible situation, he put you in the worst possible situation.
It's like a pristine prestige drama backstory for a main character.
Not even prestige. I feel like they did this like on New Girl a couple of years ago where there was like a flashback to like how funny it was that somebody's dad like, you know, hired the services of some sex workers to help the like guys lose their virginity.
It's not funny. It's not funny at all.
Yeah,
these
it wasn't
nervous,
funny on
anxious
Zoe
laughter.
Deschanel's vehicle, and it ain't funny now. You know, for starters, I hope he paid her beforehand, regardless, and I hope he tipped well.
I hadn't even thought of the labor issue.
Yeah, damn it, John! You were supposed to be keeping an eye on the labor issue, and you dropped the ball.
I'm such a bad Marxist.
You're forgiven. You get one. So definitely go see a professional.
Yes.
Right away. If your mom is being really, really, pushy about it, you know, what would be a good excuse that would not like alert a parent so much that they would start like getting really, really hovery?
That's really culturally dependent, I think.
Right.
All we know about them is that they celebrate Christmas.
Right.
So, but like, you know, this is presumably college age. You say, I'm having some troubles adjusting to college.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting really nervous thinking about the future. I'm having a hard time thinking about what I want to do with my life. And I think it would help. You could say something like, a friend of mine was really anxious about, you know, figuring out what they wanted to do next, and a therapist really helped them. And I think it would mean a lot. You know, I don't want you to say anything that would be so serious that your mom would like panic and try to intervene unnecessarily. But say whatever you need to say to get the therapist.
Definitely put your own oxygen mask on first here.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's super reasonable that you're furious with your dad. And it was unbelievably fucked up for him to, you know, give you information and then say, by the way, if your mother knew, it would ruin our marriage. And now you know this because I decided to tell you. That's a horrible position to put you in. He should never have put you in it. In addition to setting time for you to see a sex worker without talking, like, blah, everything about that is awful. So if you just need to not talk to your dad, just go ahead and do that. And if you get to a point where you, I would just say whatever you decide to do next makes sense to me. Like if you decide I cannot keep this secret from my mother, and it's not my responsibility to keep their marriage together, no one should have given me this information in the first place, I have to say something. I get that. If you decide that you cannot say that to her because you can't feel like you were even the messenger of such devastating news, I also get that.
And I just want to like underline, you are not a wimp who is overreacting. Your father made you involuntarily a co-conspirator in his own adultery.
Your dad handed you a bomb.
Yeah. And you're worried, like, I'm not sure. Is it worried that it's ticking? It's like, yeah, no, be worried. It's, your feelings are totally valid. Find a way to see a professional.
Yeah. And then, you know, like you didn't want to destroy Christmas for your sisters. And that's just so much pressure and responsibility to put on you. Because, again, of course, you know, this is devastating news. This is not news that it's just going to like casually be received and then, you know, everybody moves on. This is news that would fundamentally change. You know, it has already fundamentally changed the way you see your father. Mm-hmm. And it's going to, if anyone else ever finds out, it's going to change the way your sisters feel about him and the way your mother feels about him. And I'm just so sorry that you were put in this position. So I think mostly what I want to say, regardless of anything else, like, you were a kid. You were a very, it sounds like, relatively young person. I feel like this letter writer is probably closer to 18 than they are to, like, senior in college age.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just so much for you to deal with. So I think, number one, get that therapist. And you don't have to decide anything right now. You don't have to cover this up for your dad. You're not responsible for lying to him. But if you don't feel ready to tell your mother this, I get it. And you don't have to. So basically, focus on looking after yourself. Your dad gets to be as uncomfortable as he needs to be. and... take your time, figure out what can you live with, what's something you can envision and what's something you can't, what are the worst case scenarios, what are the worst case scenarios that you would be prepared to entertain, and what are the ones that you wouldn't be, and you know, if it were me, I would probably end up telling my mother, but I can certainly understand why someone would just decline to be responsible for sharing that information with their mom. I really, really do. But I would just be so worried that it would come out, like that if I ever got mad at my dad about something else, I would just blurt it out. I would be worried, you know, certainly like a little bit for my mom's health, just in the sense that like my guess is he's also not great about like practicing safe sex.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the sort of elephant in the room.
Yeah. But yeah, I just, you kind of have my permission to do whatever you need to do to look after yourself. And you are not overreacting. You know, even while you're waiting for a therapist, if you need like a locked journal, and definitely keep it locked, because I think a worst case scenario would be one of your siblings finds your journal and reads it. And that's how everybody finds out. But find some place to let this out that's confidential, whether that's like calling a crisis hotline or talking to someone who lives very far away and is super, super discreet, or finding that therapist, or writing it all down and then burning it. Find somewhere to communicate this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I will read this next letter. The subject is happily divorced. Dear Prudence, my ex and I divorced 5 months ago after 20 years of marriage. The breakup was difficult, but amicable. We still have friends and interests in common, and we run into each other about once a month. Recently, I've started dating a mutual friend of ours. My new boyfriend and I are very happy, and it's becoming quite serious. I know my ex will find out eventually, and I'm afraid it will hurt his feelings. He tends to have low self-esteem. My question, is it more respectful to let my ex find out organically, for example, through friends or social media? Or should I be upfront and send him a note to let him know? I don't want to rub it in his face.
Well, like, the only conflating issue, because, you know, one of the reasons people get divorced is so they no longer have to manage other people's emotions. You know, you're not responsible for other people's feelings. And, like, I'm not sure what flaunting it would actually look like. But it is a very recent divorce. Like, 5 months is pretty short.
Yeah, I think you're not doing anything wrong. So if you decide that it would feel too uncomfortable or awkward to call up or text your ex-husband and say, by the way, I'm dating someone you already know, you don't have to. That would be fine. You would not be violating some universal law of, you know, being a good person. If you did want to let him know, I think rather than a note, just a quick text or a quick phone call when you're kind of already just shooting the shit, and you can keep it brief, just go with, by the way, I just want to let you know that, you know, Timmy and I are dating now. Hope you're well. Talk some other time. Like, don't go into, you know, I wanted to break it to you kindly, or I'm worried about your self-esteem, or, hey, I wanted you to hear from me first. Like, just give him the information, keep it neutral. That would be the only, I think, non-condescending way to communicate this information to him.
Yeah, and I would say, like, I maybe, like, hold off on, I don't, like, sharing tagged photos on Facebook until, like, some time has passed, or they know first.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right, is if, I think one advantage to talking to him, just, and again, I wouldn't say you have to do this every time you start dating someone, but just because it's the first relationship sort of soon after your divorce, and it's somebody he already knows, it's a slightly different situation than if, like, you two had gotten divorced a year ago and you just, like, met somebody on a dating site, in which case I would say, no, certainly don't tell him. But it might feel a little less uncomfortable for you if, like, you and your boyfriend are out in public and you run into a mutual friend. Part of you might think, oh, no, is today the day my ex-husband finds out? And you might just feel a little more at ease if you just give him a heads up. Again, without using the phrase, I wanted to give you a heads up. Like, don't do any sort of preface of, like, I assume you're going to take this a certain way, / I assume you're not also dating. But yeah, he may very well find it painful. And if he does, he can talk to his friends about it. The beauty of being his ex-spouse is that you don't really have to worry about his self-esteem anymore. You can kind of wish him well from a distance. But that's, you know, not, what's the expression? Not my dog, not my circus?
Not my monkey, not my circus.
Not my monkey, not my circus. Sure, it's not your animal of any kind, and you're not responsible for anybody else's entertainment.
Yeah, this is one of the complications sort of unique to heterosexual relationships.
Yes, I do feel like it's a little bit of a stereotype to say that, like, every gay or bi or trans person, like, all of their exes have dated or hooked up at some point, but it's usually a much, much smaller community, so there's a little bit less of this sense of, like, how could this happen? How could someone I date someone else I also dated, or, you know, a friend? It's like, it does happen.
Yeah. I had two mutual exes who moved to the same city at the same time and met each other independent of me, and I know that because I got a text message from each of them, like, on the end of their first date.
That is so cute. How did it work out? Are they still together?
Oh dear God, no. But it was cute for a while.
Good. I'm glad it was cute for a while, and I hope someday each one of them receives a text from two of their exes, and so on and so forth. And
well, now it just sounds like a pyramid scheme. And two of their exes? Two of their exes?
Yes, yeah. I am doing multi-level marketing for getting your exes to date each other, and I'm going to start with mine. So later today, I will be choosing two of my exes who I think would be suited for one another, and I will try to engineer a meet-cute.
So, again, another excellent podcast idea.
I will 100% not be doing that. I wish them all the best, and I don't want to have anything to do with their future choices in dating because they are autonomous beings. And also, I can't imagine. Oh, I'm trying to think now of like who are the two that I would set up if I had to. I got nothing. I'm not going to do it. It's not wise. But, you know, congratulations on finding someone you like to date and on having an amicable divorce. And even if your ex-husband is real bummed out, you don't have to apologize because that's why you guys got divorced, so you could date other people. All right, last one. This one feels so, I don't know, it feels very waspy to me. Maybe just because the subject line is, am I addicted to helping my mother? And that's what I associate with waspiness. I don't know. I grew up in the Midwest. Look,
I read this, and you're going to have to read it. I read this one, and I just thought, is this something else I can blame Protestantism on?
So, am I addicted to helping my mother? Dear Prudence, my mother is almost 70, and she's constantly on the edge of being homeless and penniless. She has a BA in children's education, but is no longer interested in teaching. Really, she doesn't want to work at all anymore. She wants to retire, but she has no savings. Over the past 10 years, I've tried to help get her out of financial binds. A couple years ago, I gave her $3,000 to keep her afloat for the rest of the summer until school started again. But a month later, she called me saying she didn't know where all the money went. We've tried over the last 5 years to have her live with my husband and me. We're well off. We have plenty of room for her. The problem is that we live in another state, far from all of her friends and the rest of the family. This last summer, after her half-hearted plans to live with a flaky friend fell through, she was homeless and jobless. We took her in and hoped that she would stay. She enjoyed being here. She'd admitted that she'd been lonely before, but she went right back after the summer was over, buying plane tickets without even discussing it with us. Now she's in a bind again. She's overextended on her debts and barely bringing in any money. We told her the only help we'll give her from now on is to come live with us. No more cash. But then my sister and brother are left feeling the pressure to help Mom. They've both encouraged Mom to come live with us, but she is adamant about staying where she is. I'm so used to giving her money. It was very difficult during the holidays and her birthday to not just write her a check. I feel like I am addicted to helping her, and she is addicted to being helpless. My question is, are we doing the right thing? How can we better help my mom?
This is the most Presbyterian problem I have ever heard.
Is it at all like the movie The Ice Storm?
Yeah, well, this is a little more the House of Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, not to get into, I don't know, Max Weber and the Protestant work ethic. Your mom is 70. She's clearly not going to change. If only there were some sort of large-scale, society-wide safety net that would allow her to stay and have a dignified life in the place where she wants to with all her friends, that would be great. But the onus falls to the individual because we live in a capitalistic society. So, you know what? She's not going to change. You say you have money. Just give her money. You are now Social Security.
Honestly, that's kind of where I'm coming down on this one. Like, a lot of people, you know, will have a similar question, but it's like, you know, my mom spends all the money on, like, you know, light up caterpillar dolls, and she yells at me constantly, and I feel like I have to do this, or I'm a monster. Do I have permission to stop? And in those situations, absolutely you do. But, you know, yeah, as you say, this woman is almost 70. Hopefully, you know, being close to 70 doesn't mean that we are incapable of change. But yeah, this lifelong habit is probably unlikely to turn all the way around. You have the money. I think maybe find an amount of money a month you're comfortable giving her and do that. Like, just say, Mom, from now on, I'm going to send you a monthly check for such and such an amount, and then do it. And beyond that, then if she like gets into another bind, you can say like, nope, it's just that amount, and hold that line. But like, if you've got the money and it means she's able to live in a city where she can see her friends and doesn't feel like she's just like living in a garret, I don't know, like, what would be the value in being like, no, Mom, you've got to learn how to start scrimping and saving now. And,
yeah, like, you must express proper Protestant virtue now.
Look, I mean, I'm here for doing the best you can in terms of saving. And that's not to say that I think your mom has like behaved beautifully and perfectly. But, you know, you kind of, I don't think that addiction is like a helpful framework here, basically.
Yeah, no, it's more like living with dignity and respect. And she doesn't want to move someplace where she doesn't know anyone. And that would be incredibly isolating and kind of cruel.
And, you know, I'll just say, like, it's also okay if you decide you don't want to do that. It is 100% fine to also say to your mom, you know, you are 70 years old. I've given you thousands of dollars over the last couple of years. Whenever you decide you are happy to come and live with us, you already know she enjoys it. So it's not exactly like you're locking her away in the attic. And then to just say, but I'm done giving you cash, that would be okay too. I guess mostly what I want to say is, don't worry that if you give her money that you are addicted and enabling and a bad person. And don't think that if you decide you can come live with us for free, but we're done just giving you cash. Neither one of those is bad. I think those both make a lot of sense to me. Neither one would be like abandoning her. I lean towards just giving her the money because it's not difficult for you financially. But, you know, you have my blessing to do either one of those things.
Yeah, just don't conceptualize it as like an addiction enabling framework. Think of it more as, boy, wouldn't it be great if there was some sort of senior care in this country?
Yeah. Like, this does not feel to me like in the same category as like every time I've given my mom money, she's like bought a yacht and run away. Like, yes, it sounds like she has not done a great job planning ahead, but it also sounds like she's been teaching for decades. She would like to retire. My guess is that, you know, she never made a ton of money, even with her BA in children's education, such that she was able to build up a huge nest egg.
Teaching that famously well-paying profession.
Yeah, so this doesn't feel like, man, she really needs to like learn her lesson or like stop buying yachts. I would say if the only reason you feel guilty about doing it is this kind of vague idea that you shouldn't give cash to someone, let that fear go. Just give her some cash when you can. But that does not mean that you have to wait for her to come to you in a panic and then just blindly open your checkbook and give her everything. It's also really okay to like sit down and have a conversation with her and say like, here's the pattern as I see it. I want to be helpful to you. I also can't, drop everything constantly whenever you run into trouble. So can you tell me a little bit about your financial needs? And I can tell you a little bit about what I'm able to do. And maybe we can figure out a monthly amount that works for the both of us. And beyond that, no more. That would be great if you were able to do that. I hope that that works out for you. But you're not, you know, the addiction language just doesn't really seem necessary here. So let that burden be lifted from your shoulders. John, thank you so much for bearing with us during a number of construction-related and recording-related difficulties.
No problem. I'm apparently the technical gremlin of podcasts, as this has happened the last three times.
Is there any like last generalized piece of advice you want to leave our listeners with before you head on out?
Before I head on out, I just want to say that I've got a really big piece coming up in The Baffler on March 5th. It's about American propaganda through the ages, and particularly like the first Red Scare. It's all illustrated by me. I spent a lot of time on it. I'm really proud of it, and I hope your listeners will check it out. And remember, the only dangerous minority is the rich.
John, thank you so much. I hope that your next cheese toast is wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Phil Circus. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton, and production assistance was by Taylor Simmons. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. And remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/prudypod to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds a minute, tops. Thanks for listening. And on today's Plus segment...
Honestly, both the letter writer and the boyfriend, like, they're just being completely screwed over by this ex.
Yeah, I mean...
And the daughter, too, like, being used as bait.
That's really, really painful. To listen to the rest of that conversation, join Slate Plus now at slate.com/prudypod.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.